Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to say that, echo his words for the family of Lois Chapman, a sweet, dear lady. A lady that I met some years ago and who was someone that we fell deeply in love with because of her personality and, of course, her long standing in the Church of God. Also, for Mrs. Hamm, we found out last night that she had fallen and that they did the surgery this morning on her hip to remove a little previous damage that she had in an awful automobile accident, you remember, several years ago. And so we got a text from Connie, her daughter, this morning that said she's doing better. I mean, she's just come out of surgery and everything went well. So we're hoping and praying that everything will go fine with them. I also talked to David Overstreet down in Florida this morning. I called him to check on them. You know, they live down there in the St. Petersburg area. Actually, they live inland more towards Orlando, so they're sort of in the center of the peninsula of Florida, and they're going to hunker down and wait it out and weather the storm down there, him and his wife Sandy. And I told him we would all be praying for them, and I'd tell the congregation here. And there are others up and down Florida too that are members in God's church that we're, and of course all the people there that are in Florida that are going to face the brunt of that storm, and those up in the panhandle, Mr. Barnhouse and his sweet wife, and other members that are there in that area. And, of course, our fee site that's there in Panama City, we're watching that storm closely to make sure that it doesn't impact that city. But I was thinking this morning, if that building is still standing, we're going to go to the feast in Panama City Beach, Florida, hopefully. So anyway, hope that all of you will pray about those things and be thinking about that. Is God trying to tell us something by these massive storms and all the great earthquakes? Did you hear that one earthquake down in Mexico? 8.1. Now, that is an earthquake that will get your attention. They felt the vibrations from that and the recurring shock waves, some of them over 7.0 earthquakes that were recurring after that original one happened, and it shook all the way up to Mexico City, which is a monster earthquake. Is God trying to tell us by all of these anything by all of these events that befall our nation? You know, I don't believe that God intentionally wants to see harm come to individuals, to wreck homes and families, or to destroy human lives, or to lay waste the landscape. I don't think that's in God's mind. On the other hand, has God allowed them to happen as a result of man's unwillingness to submit to his will and obey his commandments, his statutes, and his laws? You know, God established a way of life, a code of living, that brings about all kinds of wonderful benefits. Like his own family, just like he would treat his own family, God instructs his people in a way that will be for their best interest. These laws bring about harmony. They bring about peace, long life, prosperity. You can talk to my dad. He's 92 years old now, and he will tell you, you know, he's got heard some awful news this last week. He's got cancer in his body, and the prognosis is not very good. But he told me that he's not afraid to die, because he knows that his life is in God's hands. And I told him, I said, Dad, just to hear you say that gives me a great deal of courage. And I understand what you're saying, because I know when you put things like your life in God's hands, the fear disappears. It's gone. You know that God is going to resurrect us at some point in time. For our sweet sister Lois, the same goes for her. You know, the fear was not ever there with her. She knew that her life was secure in the hands of Jesus Christ and in God Almighty. And so I understand what that means, to put your hands in God's, put your life in God's hands. Like I said, his laws bring about harmony, peace, long life, prosperity, health, happiness, protection, without fear, without war, without disease, without pestilences, without internal strife, happy marriages, wonderful and happy children, And of course, when you lay down at night, peaceful and restful sleep. Some people don't have sleep. They can't sleep at night because of all the anxiety and the worries that they have. However, man has decided to go it his own way, to plot his own course without God. Has God allowed what is happening in our world today to happen? And of course, God hasn't stopped man from making his own decision, making his own way, or choosing the lifestyle that he chooses to live. But are there consequences to these decisions? I believe there are, and not only for individuals, but for a nation as well. And I'd like to read an example to you of that today in Judges 6th chapter, if you'll turn with me. Judges the 6th chapter. This is during the time when the nation of Israel was without a king. And there was this lineage of judges that ruled over Israel that were more just wise people. And there were several of them throughout this time frame here. And you can read, that's the, of course, the subject of this book of Judges. When these people that were wise would stand up and God would inspire them to give the nation great advice about which way to turn. This chapter here, 6, has to do with a gentleman that God had something to do with that was a very, I believe, unsuspecting person that didn't believe that he had the power to make any changes in the nation of Israel, but God inspired him to do so. In verse 1 it says, "And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord." How many times have you read that in the Bible? How many times has that happened in the history of the nation of Israel, and even today? They did evil in the sight of the Lord. "And the Lord delivered them into the hand of Midian 7 years." So they were in subjection to their enemies. So we find here in the very first verse an interesting aspect of God's character. He not only allowed them to fall into the hands of their enemies, but it appears that he may have even had an actual role in them being in subjection to their enemies. You know, sometimes we forget how good things are until we lose it. And I'll give you a great example: when the power goes out. We hate it when the electricity goes out, don't we? We're so used to all the modern conveniences. When the power goes out and your cell phone dies and your TV's off and the power on the refrigerator goes off, and for 2 or 3 days, it can be quite miserable. I'll never forget the optometrist that time. I was sitting in his office, and he had this British accent, and I said, "Where are you from?" And he said, "South Africa." And I said, we got to talking, and he started sharing with me that he'd spent some time in South Africa. And he told me, and I believed him, he said, "What you folks need to do here in the United States is you need to have a 747 fueled up at all times. And when people complain about living here in the United States, you need to put them on that plane and send them to Central Africa for about 6 months. When they come back to the United States, they will kiss the very ground when they get off the plane." Because most of those people over there in Middle Africa survive on about $300 or $400 a year. They're out there rummaging through the weeds looking for ants and bugs and leaves to have one meal a day. And they're living in grass huts. They have no medical. They have no all of the electrical and the benefits that we have here in the United States. And I believed him. I believed he was absolutely right. We are so absolutely spoiled here in the United States and in most of the nations of Israel because we have enjoyed such great bounty. And sometimes we forget, as I said, how good things are. It's like your parents when you were a child, they would take away something from you. Remember when you'd be grounded and you couldn't go do this or you couldn't play with that certain toy? You thought the world was coming to an end, didn't you? When we compare our situation to someone else, like the vagabond standing on the street corner, and you know all he has is what he's got on or what he's carrying in a little knapsack, and you look at your own life, then you begin to realize how good you really have it. And I think that is what God is trying to impress upon these people. And I appreciate Michael's opening statement here about praying for our country and praying for the work that we do and praying for those people that are about to be under a terrible storm down there. I hope that that thing this morning was down to a Category 3. Maybe it'll dissipate on down to a 2 before it hits landfall up there in Florida, and I hope that is the case. But as we compare our lives to situations like that, we begin to appreciate things a whole lot more. And so that's verse 1, so by the time I get to the end of this, it ought to be 3.5 hours later, right? Verse 2, and the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel, and because of the Midianites, the children of Israel made them dens and were in the mountains and the caves and the strongholds. So the Midianites absolutely drove them up into the mountains, into these caves. They couldn't no longer just be out on the plains gardening and farming and raising their own crops. So that it was that Israel had sown, the Midianites came up, and the Amalekites and the children of East, and these are descendants of Esau, an ancient hatred that goes back many decades and centuries between the children of Israel and the descendants of Esau. You know where that originated, the story of those two brothers. Even though they themselves were reunited with one another, the family still carried some sort of resentment toward one another. And I believe that it still exists today. And they encamped against them and destroyed the increase of the earth till it came to Gaza. And there was no sustenance for Israel, no sheep, no ox, nor donkeys. They couldn't even farm because these people would come in like a plague. They would encamp in the countryside. They would eat everything, all of their crops at the time of the harvest, take their sheep and oxen, just pillage and take what they wanted. For they came up for the cattle of their tents, and they came as grasshoppers for multitude. So they were like a plague of a nation that came into Israel. For both they and their camels were without number, and they entered into the land to destroy it. Interesting. They were there to destroy the land, not to build it up, not to farm it, not to help out. They were there just to take. And Israel was greatly impoverished because of the Midianites, and the children of Israel cried unto the Lord. Same old story. Same old story. When we get in trouble, then it's, oh Lord, oh God, can you please help me? I'm in a terrible fix. Now I've gotten myself into this awful fix. Now I want you to listen to my prayer. Before then, ignore God. Oh, ho-hum, we don't need God. Everything's good. My wallet's full of money. I got food in the fridge. I got plenty of gas in my car. You take away a few things, and then all of a sudden people turn to God. It's really shameful. It's really shameful that we are that way. But here, again, we see that example. And it came to pass when the children of Israel cried unto the Lord because of Midian that the Lord sent a prophet. Now, we don't know who this prophet was. He was the nameless prophet here in this passage of Scripture. I like to think that he was a man of God that knew all of these things were coming. He was not known. His name isn't even mentioned here in Scripture. But he came and he warned the nation. He said, thus says the Lord God of Israel, I brought you up from Egypt out of the house of bondage and delivered you out of the hands of the Egyptians, out of the hand of those that oppressed you, and drove them out before you and gave you the land. And said unto them, I am the Lord your God. Fear not the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell, but you have not obeyed my voice. Our nation has been bent on absolutely rejecting God's law from every angle that's imaginable. My whole lifetime I've spent watching our nation destroy God's laws. They've rejected it. They've hated it. They've covered it up. They've boarded over it in some of these great big monuments. They've painted over it. They've kicked God's Ten Commandments off of every school, every national monument. As I said before, I don't know what they're going to do in Washington, D.C. Some of these monuments have been there since the beginning of our country. And they have upon them, in granite,
God's laws, God's Ten Commandments, references to Moses, and even the seal of our country, our nation. Go back and look at the history of the seal of the United States. You know, originally, and this has been pointed out, they wanted to put the Exodus scene on our national seal. That was actually what was represented there. And of course, members of that body that was putting together that seal for our nation decided to put those, put the eagle and with the talons holding those 13 arrows and those olive branches. And you go back and look and ask yourself, where did those symbols come from? Did we just dream those up out of thin air? Or did they come from our absolute history that goes back to the days when Moses and men like these people that we're about to read about walked the face of this earth? We'll see that. Maybe someday we'll know exactly. Down in verse 11, and they came to the and there came an angel of the Lord and sat under an oak, which was in Ophrah. Now that little town there, Ophrah, just to give you some reference, if you remember when the nation of Israel came out of the land of Egypt, they wandered in the wilderness 40 years. They eventually came to the Jordan on the east side, and they crossed on that southern Jordan Valley there into the promised land. You remember the first city they met was Jericho, and the walls of Jericho came down because of God's power. 16 miles north of that, we find this little town of Ophrah. So that'll give you some idea of where they're at. And they were under an oak tree. I remember they're still standing today, about a 75 or 100-year-old oak tree that I remember my uncles gardening and plowing out there in the fields of East Texas. That old oak tree is still standing there on a piece of property they used to own. Every time I drive by it, I think about it. I could see him sitting out there on the back of his truck, chucking some corn, getting ready. He'd go downtown and put out a little piece of cardboard that said produce for sale, and he'd sell peas and corn and watermelons. And that old oak tree was a place that they would gather under the cool of the summertime and shade and work and take care of their tractor and everything. So when I read this about the oak tree, I understand a little bit. I can kind of see that. And it said that pertained to Joash the Abiezrite and the son of Gideon threshing wheat in the winepress to hide it from the Midianites. Some of the commentators will tell you there they weren't out there on the wooden floor where they normally thresh their grain. They're over there under by the winepress, not on the boards because that would have made too much noise. He's over there by the winepress with a very small amount of grain, and he's threshing it, trying to make enough for his family to feed them. It shows a little bit of the oppression that they were under here. And it says, and the angel of the Lord appeared unto him and said, the Lord is with you, you mighty man of valor. Now that floors me, and it must have floored Gideon. For God to have an angel appear to you and say, you mighty man of valor. I wonder about some of the men in history, men like Winston Churchill, who believed at some point they realized that they discovered somewhere along the way why they were born. Some men have made that statement that I understand the purpose of my life now, because they understood that God had a hand in their life. You know, Winston Churchill, to look at him, he was not all that appealing to look at. He was kind of short and fat and bald and smoked a big old cigar. But a brilliant man when it came to his nation when they needed him the most. And I believe with all of my heart, after reading all about World War II and about his history, how he had these great catastrophes in his own lives, disasters, failures, that he eventually came to be the leader of the nation of Great Britain at a point when they needed him the very most. And I believe absolutely saved that nation from Nazi Germany and from the invasion of Germany during that time frame. And here he tells him, you mighty man of valor. He didn't believe that with his own ears. And Gideon said to him, oh my Lord, if the Lord be with us, why then are all of this befallen us? Why, God, where have you been? Why is all of these disasters coming upon our nation? You know, men ask that. Did they ever ask the question that God's hand might be in the fact that they are in bondage? We read in verse 1 that it was because of God that they were in bondage. God was the one that brought this upon them. Why? So that they would turn to Him and cry out to Him. It's the reason that they're standing there in the predicament they're in, and they're asking, where's God? Where have you been? And He's saying, I've been here all along. I'm just trying to get you to look at me, to turn to me. And He said, and where be all His miracles? We talked about here a couple of weeks ago about God's miracles and why all of these wonderful things we heard about in Moses' day aren't happening today. Well, we understood from the scriptures it's because of sin that stands in our way. We'll look at some scriptures about that. Which our fathers told us of, saying, did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt? But the Lord hath forsaken us and delivered us in the hands of the Midianites. God's probably laughing at this. I did this so you would turn to me. And the Lord looked upon him and said, go in your might. You shall save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have not I sent you? And he said to him, O my Lord, wherewith shall I save Israel? Behold, my family is poor in Manasseh, and I am the least of my father's house. You know, Saul said that in his day. David, of course, was the one out in the sheepfold. And God picked, seemingly, the one that was, to man, appeared to be the weakest and the poorest of all of them. And the Lord said unto him, surely I will be with you. And you shall smite the Midianite as one man. And he said unto him, now if I have found grace in your sight, then show me a sign that you talk with me. Here's an angel of God appeared to him. And of course, he probably thought he was a traveler. He didn't really know that this was an angel of God at first. But what is it in man that needs this inner reassurance that God is with us? You know, Moses did. You know, when he said, how do I know you're going to be with me? God said, you know, throw down your staff, and it turned to this serpent, you know, and he picked it back up. He said, stick your hand in your jacket there, in your clothing, and he pulled it out, and it was all leprous, and he put it back in, and when he pulled it out again, it was fine. We needed that kind of reassurance. Remember, Hezekiah said, you know, I know you can make the sundial go forward, the shadow go forward, but what if you could make the sundial go backward by 10 degrees? Now, that would be something. I would believe you then. You know, there is this idea that there is no, that the revelation of God is a rarity today, isn't it? And it was in Gideon's day, I believe, as well. So he wanted to see a sign, and he said, depart not hence, I pray thee, not come till I come to you, and bring my present and set it before you. And of course, he brought the kid, the unleavened cakes, and the basket with the broth in it. And then in verse 20, an angel of God said unto him, take the flesh and the unleavened cakes and lay it up on the rock and pour it out on the broth. And he did so. This reminds me of the story of Elijah when he was pouring that sacrifice out on the rocks there and he poured the water on it. You remember the story. And the angel of the Lord put forth the end of his staff that it was in his hand and touched the flesh of the unleavened cakes. And there arose a fire out of the rock and consumed the flesh and the unleavened cakes. Then the angel of the Lord just disappeared right out of his eyes, right out of his sight. That would have been enough, you know. That would have been enough for me. And when Gideon perceived that he had seen an angel, he says, alas, O God, for because I have seen an angel of the Lord face to face. He thought, like Moses did, I'm going to die because I've seen an angel of God here. And he built an altar there. And it came to pass, down in verse 15, that it was so that Gideon heard the telling of the dream and the interpretation thereof, and he worshipped and returned into the host of Israel. And said, arise, for the Lord had delivered into your hand the host of the Midians. I think I skipped a page there, didn't I? I did. Sorry about that. The same night, and the Lord said unto him, take your father's young bullock, even seven bullocks 7 years old, and throw down the altars of Baal that your father has cut down, that your father hath, and cut down the grove that is beside it. So here's the very first act God gives to Gideon. He was to destroy their pagan altars that his own father had set up. And they did. They tore down these altars of Baal. And of course, Baal was the chief deity of the ancient Canaanites there.
And they had Ashtaroth, which was the goddess of erotic love, and they had these temples. They worship under these green trees, and you remember in the scripture it says they worshiped under every green tree and upon every high hill. And they had these celebrations that were like a frenzied dance that they danced around, and they had this cult-type prostitution that worshipped in these temples that men and women would go in and be a part of some sort of an orgy. And in some of the most extreme cases, they had human sacrifice. That's what was going on in Israel. And God instructed him to tear down these and build an altar of the Lord on top of the rock. And he ordered the place, the second bullock, and offered the burnt offering. And Gideon took 10 of his men. I'll skip down here. They had to go by night because they were afraid of the people of the land there. And if you remember the story, you remember when Jeroboam was king over the northern tribes of Israel. You remember when the man of God came along and he walked up to the altar and said, "Oh, altar." And he began to prophesy that there's going to come a man, Josiah by name, and he is going to burn men's bones upon the ashes of this altar. And Jeroboam saw that and he said, "Get a hold to that man." And all of a sudden his arm dried up into a stick. He couldn't even pull it down. And he prayed to God. He said, told the man of God, "Pray to God that you will restore my arm," and he did. That prophet had prophesied because of their absolute turning from God and their worshiping of all these pagan gods. And here they are again. My point is, though, when you begin to try to destroy the religion, the false religion of some of these people, you better be careful. Because it can cost you your life. They intended to kill that man of God, and they will here with Gideon and his men. Look what happens. When they destroyed that altar and they set up the altar of God, they cut down the grove, down in verse 29. They said, "Who has done this?" And Gideon, the son of Joash, "And bring out your son that he may die." Look down there in verse 30. They're ready to kill Gideon and all the men that were with him. And they went on to give him a nickname called, down in verse 32, Jerubbabel, or Jerubbaal, which means enemy of Baal. They actually called him by name, Jerubbaal. But down in verse 34, "But the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon, and he blew the trumpet, and Abiezer was gathered after him." And the men of Abiezer were with him in that case there. They followed behind him, and they joined with him. And he sent messengers throughout all Manasseh, and he gathered after him. He sent messengers to Asher and to Zebulun and Naphtali, and they came up to meet him. Now here are all the ambassadors of all these tribes of Israel, and they're coming together. Down in verse 36, "And Gideon said unto God, if you will save Israel by my hand, as thou hast said, behold, I will put a fleece of wool on the floor." And of course, this is, again, here's another sign for him. He wanted to reassure and assure himself again that God was really with him. So he put this fleece out. And when the dew came along, there was no dew on the fleece. And then he did it backwards, you know, where he put it out there. And he saturated it. And I mean, you can read through this. I won't take the time to go through that. But both ways, God performed this great miracle and showed him that God was with him and reassured him. And again, down in verse chapter 7 of verse 1, "Then Jerubbaal," which is Gideon, "and all the people that were with him rose up early and pitched beside the well of Herod, so that the host of the Midianites were on the north side of them by the hill of Morah in the valley. And the Lord said unto Gideon, the people that are with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into the hands of Israel, lest Israel vaunt themselves against me and say, my own hand has saved me." You know, God has come to our rescue on a number of occasions, hasn't he? In my own life, I can certainly say that's the case. And right when there was, I felt in some cases, there was no way out. There was no possible route of escape, no solution, no path. But eventually, a solution did present itself, and it wasn't my own doing. And I realize that now.
God wanted Israel. He could have built a mighty army of the Israelites and just totally annihilated. By the way, these men of Midian were 135,000. Now imagine 135,000 men, camels, tents out here in a valley somewhere. That's a pretty good size army of men. And they're about to go to battle with them. And can you imagine what was going through their minds? But God was going to make a point here. He says, lest they vaunt themselves and they don't give me the credit. They think by their own might they overcome them. Down in verse 3, now therefore go to the proclaim in the ears of the people, whosoever is fearful and afraid, let him return and depart from Mount Gilead. As I said, now here we have the Israelites under Gideon, 32,000 strong, against an army of 135,000. On this day, when he said those that were fearful, and by the way, if you go back in the book of Deuteronomy, it tells us there's some instructions for going to war that God gave to Moses. And he says, all the men that are afraid, let them stay in their tents, lest they make these other men afraid. There was actually a law for going to war. There was about four or five different cases where a person was not to go to war. First was a man, if he had just built a house and he hadn't dedicated it, he was allowed to go back to his home. Another one, a case, was as if a man had just been married and he hadn't even had a chance to go on the honeymoon. He too was allowed to return to his home. And there was about three or four different cases, but one of them was if someone was fearful, he was allowed to go back home and not go to war with the men of war, lest he bring fear upon all of them. And that's what they did here. 22,000 of them walked away this day. 22,000. So we started with 32,000. Now we're down to 10,000. And the Lord said unto Gideon, the people are yet too many. Bring them down to the water, and I will try them there. And, of course, they had this little exercise where they determined who was going to kneel down and lap like a dog, or some of them would pick the water up into their hands. And through this process, down in verse 9, and the number of them that laughed, putting their hand to their mouth, were 300 men, but all the rest bowed down their knees to the water. And God said, okay, those 9,700, they got to go. Now we're down to 300 men. This is an amazing story. Down in verse 8, so the people took victuals in their hands and the trumpets, and they set all the rest of Israel, every man to his tent, and retained those 300 men and the host of Midian beneath in the valley. Now, how would you like to have been one of those guys in that army of 300? And you're looking at 135,000. I put some odds here. We began at 32,000. We dwindled it down to 22,000. Then there was only 9,700, and then we dwindled that down to 300 against the army of 135,000. That's 450-1 odds. Nowhere in any kind of a realm of possibility would any general take that few of men and try to go to battle with 135,000. There was a man in World War I. His name was Frederick Lanchester. He actually created, he was a brilliant man. He was an automaker back in the very early 1900s, long before Ford ever created his first automobile. He was a genius. He was an engineer. He worked in all kinds of designs that we use in engines today that are attributed to him. He had gotten patents for many of those. But during World War I, he came up with these formulas for deciding how to go to war and what kind of force you should use. They call it force concentration or force ratio, if you will. And you can go look at some of his formulas. They're really complex, but it tells you how you can divide your forces, and the fact that you divide your forces into two armies facing one army increases your odds for like four times. And he studied all of this. If he had these 300 men, he would have said, go home. Because there's no way they could have faced the army of this magnitude. And it said down in verse 9, and it came to pass the same night that the Lord said unto him, arise, get thee down to the host. And he delivered them, for I have delivered them into your hand. And of course, Gideon was allowed to go down there and creep up right to the very edge of the enemy, who were like grasshoppers, it says, for multitude down there in verse 12. And one of the the Midianites heard him say, "Behold, I had a dream, and lo, a cake barley of bread tumbled from the host of Midian, came into the camp and smote it, that it fell and overturned it, and the tent lay along." In other words, a tent fell down. When Gideon heard that story or heard that dream, he realized God had actually put that army into his hands, given that army into his hand. And he said, and one of the guys said, "This is nothing else but the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash." Over in verse 15, and it said, "And it was so, when Gideon heard the telling of the dream and the interpretation thereof, that he worshiped and he returned to the host of Israel," gave him a lot of confidence, a lot of courage at this moment that God really is doing this. "Arise, for the Lord has delivered into your hands the host of the Midians." And he divided the 300 men into three companies, and he put trumpets in every man's hand with empty pitchers and lamps within the pitchers. They took a lamp, put this earthen vessel over it so it would hide the light. And he said to them, "Look on me and do likewise, and behold, when I come out to the side of the camp, it shall be that as I do, you do also. And when I blow the trumpet, and all that are with me, then blow you the trumpets also on every side, and say, the sword of the Lord of Gideon." So Gideon and the 100 men that were with him came to the outside of the camp at the beginning of the middle of the watch, and they had but newly set the watch, and they blew the trumpets and brake the pitchers that were in their hands. And the three companies blew the trumpets and brake the pitchers, and beheld and held the lamps in their left hands and the trumpets in their right hands to blow withal. And they cried, "The sword of the Lord of Gideon." Notice they don't have a sword in their hand. You read through this a lot of times and you miss things like that. They got a trumpet in one hand and a candle in the other. And they're shouting, the sword of the Lord of Gideon." In the quiet stillness of the night, while the enemy was rolled up in their beds, all of a sudden there's a blast of trumpets that startled them out of their sleep. They were half dressed. They stumbled out of their tents, only to be surrounded by these torches of the enemy, and it was the armies of Israel. They couldn't tell who was friend or foe. So they began slashing at one another with their own swords. And you can do the math. If all of them got up and in their sleep tried to kill four or five different guys, their numbers would have dropped immediately to about 30 or 25,000 just within a few moments. And, of course, that number dwindled even farther down. "And they stood every man in his place round about the camp, and all the hosts ran and cried and fled. And the 300 blew the trumpets, and the Lord set every man's sword against his fellow, even throughout all the hosts. And the hosts fled to Beth-shittah in Zeretha, and to the border of Abmeholah unto Tabeth." And I hope I got all those names correctly pronounced there. "And the men of Israel gathered themselves together out of Naphtali and Asher and Manasseh and the Midianites." And, of course, they went on to pursue them and to kill their kings. Down in verse 10 of chapter 8, it says, "About 15,000 men, all that were left of all the host of the children of the east, for there fell 120,000 men that drew the sword." Down at the very end of that next chapter, or down in verse 28, we'll finish up here at this last verse. "Thus was Midian subdued before the children of Israel, so that they lifted up their heads no more, and the country was in quietness 40 years in the days of Gideon." They tried to get Gideon to be their king after this and lift him up, make him king over all of Israel, and he wouldn't have nothing of it. I like Gideon's character, but more importantly, I like the way God rescued that nation out from under the heel of their adversaries. In Hebrews 11th chapter, Gideon is mentioned. I'd like to go over there real quickly, and we'll close here. Hebrews 11th chapter. Hebrews 11, down in verse 32. This is called the faith chapter. We know that all of these examples here are given of men of faith, and men and women, I should say, of faith throughout the history of the nation of Israel. And down in verse 30, it says, "What shall I say more say? For the time would fail me to tell you of Gideon." I took the time today to tell you of Gideon, of Barak, and of Samson, and Jephthah, and David also, and Samuel, and of the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms like Jericho, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions. Remember Daniel's story. Quenched the violence of fire. We talked about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Escaped the edge of the sword. Out of weakness were made strong. Waxed valiant in fight, as Gideon's men did. Turned to flight the armies of the aliens. And I'm reminded of Hezekiah when the Assyrians came down and surrounded Jerusalem, and how he went in and prayed to God. And the same thing happened to those Assyrians. Women received their dead, raised to life again. Others were tortured, not being delivered, not accepting deliverance, I should say, that they might obtain a better resurrection. And others had trials of cruel mockings and scourgings. Of course, the prime example there is Jesus Christ. Yea, moreover, in bonds and imprisonment, they were stoned, they were sawn asunder, were tempted, they were slain with a sword, they wandered in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, and tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and in mountains and dens and caves of the earth, just like the men and women of Israel there that were left up there in those mountains trying to survive. All these have obtained a good report through faith, having not received the promise, God having provided some better thing for us, that they with us should not be made perfect. Of course, that we would all be joined together at some point. So in down in verse 12, chapter 12 and verse 1, it says, wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight. You know, I've read this scripture my whole life, and it really never dawned on me till I read this morning that he's talking about someone who's running a race. Now, when you're running a race, you don't go pack on a whole bunch of weight and put a big backpack on and you put ankle weights on, unless you're trying to get in shape. When you're running a race, you take all the weights off of you. You want to be as light as possible, both physically and emotionally. He's saying, lay aside every weight. I wrote down in my notes here, what does that mean? What weight do we carry around? Well, I wrote worry, fear, anxiety, bad habits, even maybe projects or hobbies that can get in your way or separate you from God. Sometimes you got to lay aside every weight that you have. And notice that in this verse, the sin that does so easily beset us. So weight is one thing. Sin is something else, altogether different. We have to jettison sin out of our lives. Whatever sins we have in our life, we've got to push it out through the help of Jesus Christ and get it out of our lives and jettison it away from us. Notice what he says. And let us run with patience the race that is set before us. That word patience there is a little bit misleading, because when you run a race, you're not really all that patient, are you? A runner is not very patient. What he actually means here is run the race with endurance and with perseverance. Don't ever give up. You keep going no matter what. After you've done these things, you've put away the weight and you've jettisoned sin out of your life, then persevere to the very end and God will be with you. You remember Paul said, for I'm ready to be offered, and the time of my departure is at hand. I have fought a good fight. I finished my course. I kept the faith. Henceforth, there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, shall give me at that day. And not me only, but unto all them also that love his appearing. You know, these great hurricanes and earthquakes we hear about in our news Some of them we will experience ourselves, like our brethren that may be down there in Florida this week, this weekend. May only be happening by chance. I agree, that may be the very possibility. There have always been hurricanes. Some of the worst ones were back in early 1900s down here in Galveston, Texas. But there may come a time when human beings will see phenomenal events begin to unfold that will be a warning sign from God. And the purpose will be to get our attention and to call out to Him and fall upon His salvation from an overwhelming odds that we may be facing before us. We may at that time experience the very power of God to save each and every one of us. And we will know that it was by His hand that we are saved. In Gideon's mind, there was no doubt of that.